Welcome to the Awaken Podcast. At Awaken Church, we are passionate about wrestling with and being unraveled by the Christian scriptures. Ideally, we do this together around the table in the neighborhood of Bowness. As we see it, Jesus has invited all of us to encounter him in a diverse community and participate with him in a mission of loving our neighbors. Welcome to episode 6 in the Garden Series. I am in my basement late at night. Hopefully it will be very quiet. Everyone is sleeping. And this has been on my mind for the past while. I'm going to do a talk on Jesus and creation and the reason why the incarnation is one of the most important parts of what it means to be a Christian and a follower of Christ for me. I think when we consider the ways the Bible teaches that Jesus is the creator, that Jesus is more than a shaman or a guru or a healer or a wisdom teacher, but that Jesus is creator. And in the flesh, it takes us out of our head and puts us back into our body. And we can see all of the knowledge and truth that creation has for us. So one thing that's on my mind all the time, especially right now in the spring and when I'm working in the garden, is the creation story of Adam, the first human, created from the soil. And that word in Hebrew is Adama. They're almost the same word. One is masculine and one is feminine. God takes the masculine, takes the Adama, the feminine soil, and then breathes his wind or his breath or his spirit into the Adama, and it is animated and becomes Adam, a human being. That the first human being is made of soil and wind is quite profound. And then if you grew up in a church similar to the one I did, you probably heard the Adam and Eve story, like where Adam was this man who was kind of in the garden and he was given this task, this project of dominating the creation and having, you know, ruling over all the animals, naming all the animals, kind of, you're going to need a real tough guy for that. And then he realizes that he's alone. God realizes he's alone, and this is no good because all the animals have someone to mate with, but Adam doesn't. And so God creates a woman from Adam's rib, and then she's presented to him naked, and he's like, oh, perfect. Someone, this will help me in my problem of having no one to mate with. That story can be so deeply dehumanizing and problematic when it's interpreted that way. And when you go and read the Bible critically and you read that passage in Genesis, read it responsibly and kind of do some research and get into the Hebrew, you'll see that nothing could be farther than from the truth. That story, that very ancient story, it humanizes us. It's a gift that God took soil and wind and created a human being. And then when that human being, to sort of solve the problem of this human's aloneness and lack of community, this human's isolation, God could have just created another human out of the soil. God could have done lots of things, but to split this human into two, male and female, and then to tell those two humans that they have to love their neighbor as themselves is very profound. Because when they look across at each other, it's like, I am you and you are me. The first humans to come from soil and divine breath. And then to be told in the creation story that these humans are made in the image of God. I've listened in my life to a lot of wonderful talks about what that means, image of God. It's been meaningful at times to reflect with friends, and I often hear a lot of the same stuff. To be made in the image of God means to be creative or to be relational or to be social, to have language, or to actually look like God. Perhaps God has, you know, stands upright with two eyes and two ears. And but when we understand the idea of image of God in the ancient Near Eastern context, it's actually quite simple. Image of God is a title given to the king, ruling authorities. In the ancient Near East, kings were often viewed as being the image of God. Culture groups, the king was viewed as being half human, half God, that this king would truly represent and embody their God to the people. And when God creates the first humans and says, this is the image of God, it's associated with that text that says that they are to have dominion and rule over creation. It's like, you are king and queen, you are rulers, you are the divine authority. And by creating them at the same time in the image of God, there's no irresponsible hierarchy. they're made to rule together, to bear the image of God, to bear the authority of God, to care for creation the way the Creator would care for creation. And so what do human beings do with that authority to rule and to dominate, that authority of God to represent to creation? Not far after they're exiled from the garden where God dwells, they're building a tower and an empire trying to become like God. They're trying to dominate and force everybody in the world to speak the same language and work on the same project. They take their power and are immediately dominating and ruling in all the wrong ways. And so God could just take that back and say, never mind, you are not good. I don't want you to have the keys to this precious, precious creation of mine because you're damaging it. That's not what happens. He continues to entrust people with that, with those keys, with that authority. And it's quite profound that human beings are given this image of God. And when we think of who God is, even early on in the book of Genesis, and we reflect on what it means that God is creator, that's a really important idea, that God created the material world. God created the garden. God created the earth, the water, the sky, the stars, the moon, that material world that as evangelical Christians, we're not really used to paying much attention to, I think. Throughout the entire scripture, just to stop in the Old Testament for a second, that God's breath is hovering over the chaotic waters in Genesis 1. We continue in the biblical story and we see that idea come again when Moses is standing at the chaotic waters of the Red Sea with a group of very afraid enslaved people with him who are fleeing Egypt. And it says that the wind of God is kind of hovering over the chaotic waters of the Red Sea, the breath of God, that creator spirit of God is going to blow upon those waters and calm them, calm those waters and separate them so that the people can walk through on dry ground. Because as the creator of the waters, he has authority over the waters. In the book of Numbers, God literally can create bread from nothing. Every morning when the people wake up, there's little bits of this bread-like substance on the ground, and it's new every morning, and people can't store it up, they can't hoard it, but they are sustained in the wilderness. And the Creator God can do that. He can create bread from stones. He can create bread in the middle of the wilderness. In the book of Numbers and in the book of Exodus, there's stories where the people have no water. And that's not a problem for the Creator God. Moses strikes a rock and water just bursts out because the Creator can do that. He can create water from nothing. He can make the stones flow with water, literally. There's stories in Moses' life and also in Elisha's life where the people come to water that it's poisonous. It's bitter. They can't drink it. It's not safe for them. And because of the Creator God, Moses can simply toss a stick into the water and it's made sweet and it's made good for drinking. The authority that the Creator has over the creation is unfathomable. We find stories throughout the scriptures that describe the creation story and kind of describe what it means that God is creator. One of my favorites is in Job 38, when God finally shows up and speaks to Job, who's been kind of demanding God give an answer for his suffering. And the first thing God says, the Lord says to Job in Job 38 is, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy, who shut the sea with doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made the cloud its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors and said, thus far shall you come and no further. Have you commanded the morning since your days began?" In the book of Psalms, all throughout, you'll find many times throughout the book of Psalms, you'll find what's called a creation psalm, where the psalmist says, look out at creation, it has knowledge for you. The material world, the created world, has truth for you. Pay attention. In Psalm 19, verse 1, It says, the heavens are telling the glory of God. And in Hebrew, the word heavens doesn't mean some celestial realm where there's angels and spiritual beings, but the heavens is, in Hebrew, the sky, the skies. The skies are telling the glory of God, and the firmament, another word for sky, proclaims his handiwork. In verse 4, he says, in the heavens he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom from his wedding canopy, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. In Psalm 33, beginning in verse 6, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all their host by the breath of his mouth. He gathered the waters of the sea as in a bottle. He put the deeps in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. All living things, all breathing living things, stand in awe of their creator. And lastly, a creation psalm in Psalm 65. The psalmist says, praise is due to you, O God, in Zion. You visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide the people with grain, for so you have prepared it. You water its furrows abundantly, settling its ridges, softening it with showers, and blessing its growth. You crown the year with your bounty. Your wagon tracks overflow with richness. Have you ever considered the wagon tracks of God? Not me, but the psalmist here did in Psalm 65. The pastures of the wilderness overflow, and the hills gird themselves with joy. The meadows clothe themselves with flocks. The valleys deck themselves with grain. They shout and sing together for joy. The earth is abounding, girded with joy, all of creation. When we, especially right now, it's a May long weekend. Today I just saw tons of people outside in their garden, like they're already sunburned. Their soil is under their fingernails, and there's all this new life and new flowers, the smell of compost. It's like there's so much life, unfathomable amounts of life. All of the living things, the robins, the dirt, the soil, the flowers, the trees, the wind, the little buds of, on the big poplars are like about to burst with life. And it's just reminded me so much that as Christians, we need to be paying attention to what the created world says to us. His creator, and he created this and created human beings and placed us here to care for it and to bear the image of God to it, then we need to pay attention to it. And I'll be honest, since COVID-19 struck and we've been put in isolation, the lack of shared space with bodies has been a huge grief for me. I know that we have Zoom, we have podcasts, we can call each other and all that stuff's happening and it's so great, but it's not the same. Like it's literally, it's huge and it's hugely exhausting to be in a Zoom meeting because our bodies aren't together. I've been talking with people lately this week about how churches will be able to gather together, but we won't be able to sing. And it's like, that's okay. You don't need to sing to worship, right? Singing and worship are not you can worship without singing. But what's interesting is that when you sing together as a group, there's something going on that's even beyond our comprehension. When you're singing together, everybody inhales at the same time. And you sing and you're standing up straight, your shoulders are back, you're singing, and everybody exhales at the same time, inhales at the same time. You're doing this collectively for like 5 to 30 minutes. And the way our breathing is aligned in the room together, the way our bodies are connected, is there are things happening and connections being made that are beyond our comprehension. We're not aware of it, but the endorphins are being released. Studies have shown that our blood pressure changes in response to other bodies. If you've ever held a newborn baby against your chest, we know that skin to skin is so important for new babies and their parents, because the baby's vitals will like be affected by the parent's vitals, like body temperature and heart rate and not be completely imitating one another, but there's an influence, there's an impact. Our bodies are connected, and it's important that even obviously look at this virus and how quickly it spread. It shows us that we are deeply connected human beings. The fact that a virus could spread so quickly is a testimony to how deeply connected we really are as embodied people. And so to put us, you know, alone in our houses on Zoom singing, there's something about it that just doesn't feel sincere and doesn't feel right. And sure, we can worship God alone in our living room. We don't need to be together singing songs. But there's an embodiment piece that is missing. Someone said to me lately, they're like, Nikayla, you know, I miss your sermons. I miss watching you preach because you preach with so much passion. We should just set up a camera and you could preach in the church and then as it, you know, we'll just like watch it. And I was like, no, you don't understand. I don't have those skills. I can never just preach to a camera. Like, what do you mean? I've seen you preach 100 times. I'm like, you don't understand. When I'm in the room preaching in a small room, I'm watching every other person in the room. I'm aligned with and tuned in to all the other bodies. I can tell by your posture and your body language if you're engaged or if you're bored. And I'm reading your signals and your cues, and it's this entire dialogue happening. And so I can perceive when people are being inspired or they're engaged with a certain point I'm making. And then I can quickly pick up when it's over their head or when it's kind of boring or I've just been repeating myself too much, and I can adapt and move on. Now, you give me a topic and a camera, it doesn't feel the same because I'm not in the same room with you, in our body with each other. And that's such a strange and new thing, definitely in the evangelical world I grew up in. Bodies didn't matter, only souls mattered. Bodies were, who cares? The material world was corrupt and sinful, and the spiritual world is the only world that matters. And now as Christians, we're trying to exist in a virtual world. Like, what is, that's like this third space I don't understand. Like, is this the material world that's bad? Is it the spiritual world that's good? The virtual world, is it, it's good because I can be alone and listen and not be distracted by, I don't know. I don't understand. But I know that if we declare at the heart of our faith that God is creator and that creator God became flesh in Christ, then the material world should matter a lot to us. We need to be in our body and we need other human bodies. And in our, when we're embodied well, we are actually more capable of taking care of each other, loving each other as ourselves, and taking care of the created world. To transcend creation, to say that the goal of my faith is to leave my body and transcend and get to some other place. It's somewhat irreverent to the God who creates us and connects us. The Adam is made from the Adama with the wind of God in our lungs. Wind, breath, spirit, it's the same word in Hebrew. The wind of God, the breath of God is what parted the Red Sea. The wind of God is what's in my lungs and in your lungs. We inhale and we exhale. That wind, that breath of God that animated the first human. Leaving our heads is very difficult for Western enlightened evangelicals. We've definitely inherited that Greek binary or the Greek dualism of flesh and spirit. And so if you can think about it and make sense of it with your intellect and your reason, then that's a higher good. It's virtuous to be intellectual and have knowledge and have reason. I definitely remember in my early 20s being big on apologetics. Like if I could just teach people that Christianity was the most reasonable and rational way of thinking, then surely they would come to their senses and convert to my religion. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. It's reason and intellect. And when Jesus speaks, he says, look at the lilies, look at the ravens. There's something about leaving our heads and entering our body and even entering our breath. Even the name Yahweh sounds like a breath. There's a story in 1 Kings 19 where Elijah is fleeing for his life and he's terrified. He says he wishes he could die. And God visits him and says, why are you here? And when God says he will appear to Elijah, there's like this mighty wind that shakes the mountains. There's an earthquake with a fire and all of these things. Elijah expects to be kind of overwhelmed with wonder that God is there. But it's a sound of silence, a sheer silence, a silence that I don't think we could ever hear in the city. A silence that requires one to be in the wilderness. And it's in that silence that he hears the voice of God. And there's a rabbinic tradition that what he heard was the name Yahweh, which when you say it properly in a good Hebrew accent, it just sounds like a still small voice, like Yahweh. Like it's a small sound, Yahweh. And so there's been beautiful poetic speculations that what he heard was the name Yahweh, which is an inhale and an exhale. God is creator. God is God of life, then wherever there is death, God makes life. So Jesus becomes flesh. Creator God becomes human. Creator becomes Homo sapien. Creator becomes creation. A young baby breastfeeding, breathing, inhaling, exhaling, aligning his body, his vitals, with his mother's. This is at the core of the Christian belief, the incarnation, the incarnate God. God become flesh. You cannot have a low view of the created world if at the heart of your faith is a belief that God became human. The created material realm can't be corrupt and broken if God can enter into it and occupy it. Jesus isn't half God, half human. Jesus wasn't just God on the inside where his soul is and human on the outside where his body is. Every single cell of Jesus' body was fully human, fully God. This is why Jesus, the Creator, can walk on water, can calm the storm, can speak to the chaos, and it yields to him. This is why Creator Jesus can cause bread to flow bountifully from a few loaves. This is why Creator Jesus can turn water into wine. When Jesus encounters anything that's dead, it springs to life. When he encounters sickness, there's healing. It's funny, in all of these commentaries and books about the miracles of Jesus, they always break it up like healing miracles and nature miracles. The nature miracles is like when God has command over creation, when God can tell the storm to be quiet or he can walk on water. And then we have the healing miracles. He heals a leper. He heals a blind person. He heals someone with a fever. And I'm like, aren't those all creation miracles? Aren't those all nature miracles? Having authority over a sick body and having authority over a chaotic body of water, isn't it the same? Isn't my human body a part of creation? There can be chaos in my body that I have no control over, like there can be chaos in the sea that I have no control over, and the Creator God can speak authoritatively to both. So if the Creator can take on the flesh, life incarnate, contagious life, then bodies matter. Right? Bodies matter. Christ felt hunger, thirst. But bodies matter. We declare at the heart of our faith that Jesus is King. And it's kind of a title that doesn't land the same in our context as it would have in Jesus' context, because we don't have a king in Canada, right? We have a prime minister. And to say that Jesus is prime minister is not at all what it means to say Jesus is king. We didn't, you know, vote in a democratic system for Jesus to be king. We don't have kings. We don't have dynasties. And that's just not how it works in our cultural context and in our social imagination. So when we think Jesus is king, I don't know, what do we think of like Elvis, like the king, like he's the best at doing what he does? I don't think so. I think when we go back into that ancient context, we see that to say Jesus is king was even a profound paradox in the ancient context, because Jesus is king, but not like any other king that's ever existed in the whole history of the world. Even not like any president or prime minister or boss or employee or any person who's ever been in a seat of authority. Jesus isn't like any of them, any of us. What kind of king lives in poverty? What kind of king never demands respect? Never scoffs, never gossips or lies or tries to save his own reputation. He never picks up any weapons. He doesn't have a storehouse, no storage room, no servants, no fear of strangers. When Jesus sees people, he doesn't see slaves or free. He doesn't see Jew or Greek, male or female, old or young, sexually chaste or sexually deviant. He doesn't see that. He doesn't have to build walls around his city to keep the stranger out. He doesn't have to be afraid that there's not enough food. He's completely generous and abundant. And he entered, took on flesh, and he interacts and touches flesh to say that this is good and it's worth saving. When Jesus sees people, he says, I made you. I formed you in your mother's womb. The breath in your lungs, that's my breath. I did that. You are my creation. I am with you. It's why I believe that the way of Jesus is literally the only way. It's the only hope we have. the hostility in our world right now between genders, between ethnicities, between social classes, Jesus's way is a way of non-resistance, non-violence. It's the only hope we have. The self-emptying love of Christ, the contagious life of Christ, that in one the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew's Gospel, he stands up, he gives this amazing sermon, interacting in dialogue with the Old Testament and the teachings of Moses, and then he comes down from the mountain and everyone's like, wow, and he goes and touches a leper, which is strictly forbidden in Torah to touch the leper, but the leprosy isn't contagious, it doesn't infect Jesus, rather the life of the Creator Christ touches the leper and infects the leper with life, and his youth is restored. And you're like, okay, yeah, it was probably like, you know, this leper guy must have been a really good, humble, righteous man. And then the very next story in Matthew's Gospel, it's a Roman centurion. Like, this is not on, these are, Roman centurions were not on the inside for like Jewish rabbis. Because he didn't see a difference. These are human beings who were hurting and there was death in their body. And he's a God of life, and his life is contagious. There's this quote by this mystic Hafiz, and he says this, admit something. Everyone you see, say to them, love me. Of course, you do not do this out loud. Otherwise, someone would call the cops. Still, though, think about this great pull in us to connect. Why not become the one who lives with a full moon in each eye that is always saying with that sweet moon language what every other eye in this world is dying to hear? I see that in Jesus. He's like, speaks life and love. And because he's nonviolent and because of his non-resistance, he breaks down the dividing walls of hostility between genders and ethnicities and social classes. The walls come tumbling down. You think that leper and that Roman centurion were friends? Do you think they would have been in the same social circles? Probably not. But when you speak life and love to people in different groups, to people who have animosity between them, those walls melt. They disappear. To think as Christians that we just need to escape our body. You know, it doesn't matter what gender you are, what ethnicity you are, what social class you are. All that matters is your soul. You would think that would help, but no, nothing could be farther from the truth. By disembodying humans, it's led to this degradation and dehumanization of people and a degradation of the created world that we are born in and exist in and die in. And all right, I'm getting carried away. Jesus dies on the cross. The creator of all life can die. There's something in that that's beyond our comprehension that I think we could meditate on and nothing else but that for the rest of our life. Paul does that same thing. Paul says, I seek to know nothing but Christ and him crucified. Like, what a mystery. I could spend my entire life trying to unpack that. And I think part of what's happening is that the reason Jesus is king is because his love is incorruptible. He goes down into poverty. He goes down where there's sickness and death, and he affects it with life. He goes down even to the grave, and he goes down, and not just into any death, right? Like, if the whole point was Jesus just needed to die to atone for our sins, he could have died in any way. He could have died peacefully in his sleep. He could have taken poison or died drowning. I don't know. He could have died in tons of ways, but that he died crucified with criminals, an excruciating, painful, violent death reserved for people who were viewed as being nobodies. Like, when we consider that Roman citizens weren't crucified, that he didn't enter into just any death. He entered into the most humiliating, powerless, vulnerable way of dying. He didn't resist death. It's non-resistance. He entered it. And on the cross, he says, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Like, he doesn't even resist while they're doing it. Forgive them. He enters into it. And 3 days later, he walks out of the tomb. Because life is contagious. He's like, where is their death? I will touch it. I'm God become flesh, and I will touch with my body all of the ways that there is death in this world, and it will come back to life. If there's hungry people, food. When it's hurting people, healing. When there's people who are afraid, he gives hope. When there's people who are wrought with grief, he brings joy. And 3 days later, he walks out of that tomb. And the result of that is those who've been made vulnerable, those who've been made weak, they don't need to fear death anymore. If we follow the king who lost it all on our behalf, then there's nothing to fear. When I look at people, why wouldn't I see and speak love and life? In Christ, Paul says in Galatians 3, there is no slave or free, Jew or Greek, male and female. It was a welcoming place for slaves and free, male and female, Jew and Greek. Wealthy and poor, afraid and powerful, weakened and strong, and in the abundance that they received in Christ, the fear melts away. If you're not afraid of death, then we can participate. We can bear the image of God to all of creation. We can join with him. We can forgive. Of course I forgive you. Of course I love you. Of course I honor you. Of course I want to share with you. Sit at my table with me. The reason Jesus is king is because of the incarnation, that the Creator God became flesh. And so as a human being made in the image of God, I have to look at the material world, at human bodies, at creation, and overwhelmed with wonder, speak love and participate with him. I'm not trying to build a storehouse and gain glory or gain authority. I'm trying to participate with Christ, and I can't do it when I'm afraid all the time. I can't do it if I'm terrified of death and I'm terrified of suffering. I'm terrified of not getting the things I think ought to be mine. When that fear is gone and I'm free to love, then the hostility and the animosity just melts away. In Matthew 14, there's a story where Jesus has just fed the 5,000. And now it says, immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I. Don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and, beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." There's so much going on in that story, but I love that Peter's just like, "I want to walk on water with you. Bid me come. I see you. You are king. You are the creator in the flesh. I'm not afraid." And he steps out of the boat onto the chaotic waters, and he looks around, and his fear of death seizes him, and he begins to sink. And what Jesus invites us to is, come towards me. Come towards me where it's difficult and terrifying. Follow me down to Calvary. Pick up your cross. Deny yourself. Don't spend all of today's energy investing in the kingdom you plan to build tomorrow. Don't spend all of today's energy investing in the wall you'll build around your city tomorrow. Follow me down. You have nothing to fear. You might be afraid of the world, but I have overcome the world, he says. We don't need to be afraid of people who are different than us. We don't need to be afraid of the people over there. We don't need to live in a world of us versus them, progressive versus conservative, liberal versus conservative, Republican versus Democrat. Jesus is like, what are you afraid of? Everybody here is longing to be loved, longing for life. Go down. Be that voice. Where there is sadness, speak joy. Where there is despair, speak hope. And this is the way of Jesus. And I in my heart, even though sometimes I wrestle with so many parts of my faith, I never doubt that the way of Jesus is the only hope we have. And if there's anybody worth taking a risk on, if there's anybody worth following, surely it's God become flesh. I've had a lot of friends in the last couple of years leave Christianity and try different spiritual traditions, practice Eastern spiritual traditions, and I've seen it be beautiful and helpful in a lot of ways in a lot of my friends' lives. And I think some of the way that in the West as Christians we've inherited the Greek dualism between flesh and spirit, it's been helpful for my friends to go to a space where they can be embodied and they can meditate and whatnot. But when I go back to the scriptures and I see that at the heart of my faith is not a condemnation of a flesh and an elevation of the spirit, it's the Creator God become creation. It's the Creator God become flesh. The incarnate Christ tells me I can take a deep inhale and a deep exhale and know that God is with me. And know that the way of Christ is incorruptible, that the way of Christ is not picking up arms to defend and demand and dominate. It's to melt my weapons down into gardening tools. And so when I work in the garden, I'm not just like, oh, it's because I really like these herbs that I can't wait to have this summer. I work in the garden because I'm like, God created this soil. Every single cell, every living organism, everything that God created with care, and I get to be a part of that. I don't know. Sometimes I get in my head and I say, I have to go out into nature so that I can encounter God, because God is out there in nature. And then I read Genesis 1 and I kind of catch myself and I remember that, no, when I go out into nature, it's me who comes bearing the image of God. And so when I hear the robin sing and it reminds me that God is with me, I think God is with the robin as well. We've been invited to participate in God's project of making all things new. And that's going to mean we leave our homes where we have big locks on our doors and big storehouses. It's going to mean we leave our heads, enter into our body, and acknowledge that all of creation has been waiting for the children of God to be revealed, as Paul writes in Romans. So I pray for you, church, every day. I miss being in the same room as you. Don't care very much for this virtual shared space right now. I would love to be with you in person, to hear you breathing. Our heart rates and our love for each other can be tangible. And so I bless you and I look forward to being with you in person. Jesus is King and we're not alone.